I am here with Dan Sean, who is most recently the author of Await Your Reply. Dan, how are you doing?
I'm doing great.
I wanted to, first of all, ask you, I had a rather funny question. I have to remark upon the frequency of automobile accidents in your work. In Await Your Reply, you have Lucy Lattimore's parents die in an automobile accident. There's the car accident excuse offered by Jonah, and you remind me of me. The car accident identity similarly appropriated by George Orson. And all this reminded me of Charlotte Hayes' death in Lolita. Similarly, in You Remind Me of Me, Jonah kidnaps Loomis in a car, and this reminds me very much of Humbert Humbert taking away Lolita.
Right.
And, of course, the epigraph of the second part in Await Your Reply is from the real life of Sebastian, whatever his secret was. I have learned one secret, too, and namely, that the soul is a manner of being not in a constant state. So I must ask you, first and foremost, about the Nabokov influence in these books, and whether this preoccupation with cars is sort of a Lolita thing. I'm curious.
The car thing is not a Lolita thing. It's just I spend a lot of time in cars, and when I was in my 20s, a psychic told me that I would die in a car accident.
really?
I haven't yet. So I have a fear of car accidents, partially because I do a lot of driving, but I'm not known as the best driver. I'm a spacey driver. My sister has me listed as one of her top five worst drivers in that she's ever driven with. I'm only at five, though.
Yeah. This psychic premonition, were there any other premonitions? Did they have any effect on your stature as a writer or anything?
No.
Go right, young man?
No, it was one of those things where it was like this weird friend of my wife who, like, fancied herself sort of like a medium-type person, and, you know, was always, like, making pronouncements and things like that. But it did stick with me. So I guess car accidents are one of my fears, along with being in a house that's burning down, which is also something that I tend to write about a lot, burning houses. The Nabokov stuff, though, I do feel like that's, like, it's a big influence on me. I mean, both Lolita, Sebastian Knight, Despair as well. I mean, which is also about
a kind of
identity theft. I don't know whether have you read Despair? It's about somebody that switches identities with a hobo. I definitely think about the Big N quite a bit. And read. I mean, in terms of people that I've read over and over, he's one of the main ones.
Was Despair one of the guides for this particular book? For
I guess I had it in mind to some extent. I don't feel like I have the same kind of intellectual or verbal chops that Nabokov does, of course. But I mean, I certainly admire him, his work, and I think about him a lot as a writer.
I wanted to also ask, since we were on the topic of mediums and the like, I mean, there are a lot of aphorisms contained in this book, the Eleanor Roosevelt maxim, nobody can make you feel inferior without your consent, and these aphorisms are almost out there for little driftwood that the characters can kind of clutch upon,
right,
but they don't actually take heed or even comprehend the aphorisms, and I'm curious if how that came about.
Well, I mean, I wanted the book to be full of a kind of webbing of different references and a level of kind of gamesmanship that it was, you know, like thinking about the ways in which we put together ideas about the self and ideas about our lives through various kinds of quotations and mediums and the way that that's actually encouraged. I mean, in our education, right? I mean, we're being presented with various models of how to behave and how to think about ourselves and so on and so forth. So I had a lot of these things that I was playing with. I mean, there's self-help stuff. There's the kinds of quotes that you see in high schools, you know, to encourage kids to be good citizens or whatever. And there's the kinds of things that people pull out when they're trying to make intellectual pronouncements, some of which are real and some of which are kind of made up. And some of them, I found some interesting quotes that were that are misattributed. So that I mean, there's a Nin quote in there that is often attributed to her, but she never really said it.
Yeah.
And that I guess is sort of like another fun thing is that there are all these quotes out there that people get attached to, but they're not really they don't really belong to those people.
This may be an obvious observation, but I wanted to compare. You remind me of me with the way you reply. You remind me of me reveals, to my mind, how characters cannot fit into the world before them.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Await Your Reply, you have a situation in which, well, let's go further.
Right.
Now you have to invent an identity to fit within the world. And I'm wondering if the idea here with Await Your Reply was to approach the same idea of You Remind Me of Me in a manner that... That was A, more representative of 21st century life, and B, represented, I suppose, a greater pigeonholing of possibility through this invention of identity.
Yeah, I mean, I think to some extent, I mean, I guess You Remind Me of Me is very much a regionalist novel in some ways, and I mean, I think I was still thinking about myself in terms of the Midwest and in terms of what the possibilities of the Midwest are, and Await Your Reply, I think, comes out of having, you know, sort of for the first time in my life, traveled a lot, and, you know, in some ways it comes out of book touring.
Free research. I know David Mitchell, he keeps meticulous notebooks
yeah.
when he is on tour.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, I guess I started to think about the ways in which the characters, even in, you know, even in Await Your Reply, would, by this point... Be in sort of a larger touch with the world,
yeah.
Almost with you know whether they wanted to or not. I mean, in Await Your Reply, people are affected by sort of like the globalization of media and
yeah.
by all of that stuff in a way that probably the people in You Remind Me of Me weren't, only because of the time period that they were in.
Yeah, I'm curious about this Midwestern jumping point
yeah.
and whether. I'm not sure if that was really a straitjacket for you, but I'm curious if it was difficult when you're starting to envelop a larger world with this book to really keep those limitations that you set up in You Remind Me of Me with the bar and so forth. And
right.
I'm curious if this
right.
to what degree this was a challenge in with Await Your Reply.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a challenge because you know a lot of the kind of energy that I get. From the landscape of the Midwest is fed into, you know, like my inspiration for writing. You know, I mean, a lot of times I'll start out with landscape and a lot of times I'll start out with these sort of isolated places that for one, whatever reason have kind of emotional touchstones for me. And so that's the place that I'm usually starting. It was fun, actually, to sort of branch out and start writing about places that I'd never tried to write about before, like the Arctic or like Ecuador or like Las Vegas. And it was also fun, kind of realizing that I didn't necessarily have to have lived in those places to write about them. I mean, I think there was a part of me that always felt that, you know, you had to have sort of like this deep, instinctive. A sense of a place before you could write about it. And I guess I feel after writing this less constrained by that sense, you know, by that old truism that you really are best when you're writing about.
This locational familiarity, why do you think it stuck around for so long and when did you become aware of it?
Well, I mean, I think that there were a lot of the writers that I really admired in my early reading were regionalists of one sort or another, like Sherwood Anderson or like Willa Cather, and that seemed to me a way to make what you were writing about distinctive and to create this world that you had a kind of proprietary hold over. And I guess I kind of held on to that because there weren't that many other people writing about Nebraska.
Yeah.
I was like, well, this is a territory that I can kind of make my own in some ways. And I guess it changed just because the stories that I wanted to write had expanded outward. With distance, I haven't lived in Nebraska since I was 18, so yeah. You know, it's probably time for me to move out in my writing life as well.
I'm wondering if you felt that regional writing was in some sense the truest way to understand human beings, because you remind me of me. There's a great understanding of and great attention to human behavior also in this book in a different manner. But uh-huh. I'm wondering if. I'm wondering how it ties into this influence of regional writing, that concern for human niceties.
Well, I've probably changed my mind a little bit, but at least when I was younger, I felt that, you know, region was a major influence on your identity in the way that race and class and gender are also, you know, huge identity markers. I had this sense that region, for me at least, was also one of those. I always thought of myself as a Nebraskan almost first and foremost when I was growing up. Especially when I moved away. I mean, that was like part of how I thought about myself, that I was this person from Nebraska who was in Chicago or in New York or whatever. And I still think, you know, every once in a while, I'll still slip and you know, I'll call Nebraska home. Like, back home, I did this. I think that's probably less of an issue for most of my students. I don't think that they feel that kind of attachment to place, with some exceptions. You know, I mean, I New Yorkers always feel like New Yorkers, I think, for their entire lives if they grew up here. If they grew up here.
As a Californian, I don't right. necessarily feel like a New Yorker, but I know what you mean.
But yeah. Californians also, I think, have that strong attachment to this idea of themselves as Californians. Yeah. A lot of the kids that grew up in the suburbs, I don't think have that kind of strong attachment to a region or to a sense of the world that's extended from we are here and this is what we're like. People in another place are different from us. That kind of feeling that, you know, I mean, San Franciscans, for example, have this really strong sense of what it's like to be a San Franciscan,
yeah.
for example.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the way that we form identity, is this sense that we're part of a smaller group.
Yeah. I'm curious, it seems to me that there are almost competing identities here, an identity you have as a Nebraskan and an identity you have also as a writer, and
right.
I'm curious what the overlap is or whether this has even been an issue for you.
Well, I guess to make reference to another great writer that I shouldn't probably compare myself to in any way, Joyce had to leave Ireland to be able to write about it, and I mean, he wrote about it with this kind of detachment and honesty that bordered on cruelty at times.
Yeah.
And I feel like that in some ways that was Nebraska was my Ireland.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
Okay.
I'm curious about this obsession with the Ivy League schools that shows up. The set shows up three times. Lucy applies only to three colleges, Harvard, Princeton, Yale. And then later, you have Breeze remarking that certain portions of the herd deserve to be thin, the ones that go to Princeton or Harvard or Yale, and they're deemed a more repulsive waste. The suggestion, though, here, and it's interesting that I, in light of your last answer about Nebraska, is that there is this common topographical point of reference for these uh-huh. various characters, but you can have so many varying reactions and yet never even understand what Princeton, Harvard, and Yale are. And I'm,
right.
I'm curious about how that set of three that had to crop up twice in this.
Okay. Well, you know, I was trying to explain this to my French translator. They're trying to explain a lot of things to my French translator
what
that
else?
Just are not working very well. Just, you know, very simple things or things that I think are simple. And now I can't, I'm not able to come up with one right off the top of my head, but I guess what I was thinking about in particular was social class and Lucy's understanding of her own social class. There's a point in the book where, you know, she has this idea of herself in high school, and it was an idea that I kind of had of myself as well, that you know, you can, that I'm going to get out of town and I'm going to become this, you know, this person that like I see on TV or read about in books, that has all, you know, like has this great intellectual life, and moves into these upper echelons of society and so on and so forth. And there's a point where Lucy realizes that no, actually that probably wouldn't ever have happened for her, because she would have had to be preparing for it from a very early age.
Yeah.
And that she wasn't groomed in some ways to become that kind of person, even though she would have liked to imagine herself as that kind of person. And I mean, I think we run up against the edges of the American dream all the time. You know, despite the fact that we still kind of cling to the idea that you can be anybody you want.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another line that comes up a whole bunch of times.
Well, it's also interesting that Lucy sees education as a quick fix climb up. I mean, you
right.
know, her
right.
allure with the mysterious teacher. Who,
right.
You know, I don't want to give it away, but
right.
but it, that to me is odd, that she should see education almost as the only tonic with which to form an identity.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that, I don't know, I'm teaching at Oberlin now,
yeah.
and I know, and I mean, you probably have seen plenty of this living in Manhattan, the obsession with getting your child into a good school, getting your child in, you know, into the right preschool, whatever. I mean, that's with this generation of kids, that started so early.
Yeah.
And it is, I think, seen as the only solution for your, you know, like, you know, like if you end up, you know, if you end up having to go to Rutgers
yeah.
or a state school or, you know, something, it's like the end of the world for a lot of these kids, you know? It's like, oh my, now my life is ruined. And I think that there's that, at least I was playing around with that, that Lucy sort of like got on her own, got drawn into that idea that if I want to be a great person, I have to go to one of these three top schools.
Yeah.
And I mean, and I mean, that's like, I mean, that kind of exceptionalism or that kind of elitism is all over the place. And you know, I mean, it's in the book world, it's in the music world, it's in, you know, every, you know, all parts of our society, that, you know, if you really want to do well, you have to go to the top places.
Well, the curious thing is, how did you stumble upon the name Lucy? Because I thought, because she's almost a half-formed character, that there was almost an anthropological suggestion with
oh,
the name.
with Lucy.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I mean, actually, I just really like the name Lucy. And I was thinking, Lucy Honeychurch, the Forrester novel.
Okay.
A Room with a View.
Yeah.
And partially thinking about her, partially thinking about names that were old-fashioned in a way that you didn't come across very often, and were not necessarily flattering names.
Yeah. like George Orson, which it's funny also because this is an assumed identity as
right,
well.
Right.
So Orson, were you thinking Orson Welles, Orson from *Mork and Mindy*?
No, I wasn't thinking about the *Mork and Mindy*. I was thinking about Welles.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I started out calling him by both names, and it just stuck through the whole novel. And he seemed like the kind of person who would think of himself in as both names.
Yeah.
I have a few acquaintances who also frequently think of themselves or are referred to by both their first and last names.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And if they refer to themselves in the third person, that causes
yeah.
additional. Well, that's interesting. I mean, this also leads me to wonder, given, without revealing the book, that there are multiple identities involved.
Right.
It seems that there were also multiple identities as you were writing the book that announced themselves. Did you know all the identities in advance, or did they kind of establish themselves through the course of writing?
I didn't know any of the shifts that would happen when I was writing the first draft.
Yeah.
And about, you know, about halfway through, I had this idea that one way to tie it together would be to merge some of the identities. but I was a little nervous about it because it seemed like such a corny sort of like cheesy pulpy idea. And then so I was resistant to it, but then like each time I sort of like gave into it, it felt like the book clicked together a little bit more in my mind and it became more fun for me.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe one of the hardest things for people of our generation is that fear of being corny or that fear of being cliched or sentimental. And in some cases, it kind of keeps you away from writing plot, because all plot is cliche in some ways. All plot is corny, especially the kinds of plots that are fun. And I was ultimately really glad to kind of give myself over to that impulse, because I feel like it changed the way that I think about what I'm doing in some ways.
But on the other hand, I must point out that you really don't give a lot of explicit clues as to what's going on in the first half of the book.
Right,
it's almost
right.
as if you're in abeyance here
right.
before you actually reveal the actual game. And I'm wondering if during the course of any of the revisions, whether the first half actually did have more explicit connections, and whether you felt that you needed to abstain from them in some capacity, or whether they were actually present at some point. I mean, how much did you think of the reader? Because the reader is going to be taking on this game of faith when she picks up the book.
Right. There was a lot of debate about that. At Random House, when I turned in the final draft, and you know there were. A group of people who wanted more in the, you know, more hints.
A group of people, factions?
Yeah, like factions.
Like 10 people?
Get this and I didn't get this and I wish there was a little more, you know, I mean, and I mean, my experience talking to readers is that, you know, it does break up into people who feel like it's too easy to figure out, and then people who feel like it's too hard to figure it out. And you know, of course, there's some people who are happy with the way it is, but it's weird to me, like how much people want to have things explained, and how much people want hints really reveals something about their personality, and that's not necessarily obvious. I mean, it's not the obvious, you know, like I don't know whether you follow Lost or not.
I do. In fact, I've been waiting on seeing the last episode because the one before that was so terrible.
Yeah,
so you know, it's like they're going to blow it. I mean,
they probably will, but the most recent one picks up, and I still have hope that they'll be able to pull it off. But you know, I was talking to a bunch of people last night after my reading, all of whom had different opinions about what degree things should be revealed and what things need to be revealed for them to be satisfied.
Yeah.
And I'm sort of in the camp that I feel like the less they reveal, the better off they're going to be.
I would agree with you.
I mean,
because
the more
no
they
way
resolve,
you can satisfy.
Yeah, there's no, I mean, and most, and a lot of the things, if they were like, oh, well, actually they're in hell, and that this is a kind of purgatory or whatever.
Yeah.
That would be awful.
Yeah.
I mean, because that would just explain everything in too neat a way.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's all Hurley's dream or something, you know?
Well, anyway, that's a whole separate discussion. But for my mind, I mean, if you read Charles Beaumont's story, The Wolfman?
Uh-uh.
It's about, I think I've actually mangled the title of the story, but it's about this guy who is utterly evil and he's kept in a cage.
Uh-huh.
And it's a 5-page story. It just, everything Lost has taken like years to do.
Uh-huh.
It's the exact same thing. And then he gets let out.
It's
and
Charles
of course,
Beaumont?
It's Charles Beaumont. And when he gets let out, well, of course, Nazi Germany happens. And
oh,
so,
okay.
So, and it's 5 pages.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, I think that maybe, and to tie this into your book, I'm wondering if, just because I noticed that this book was far tighter in the way that you wanted to convey the story. And I'm curious how much hacking you did and how much you were concerned with limited amounts of information sustaining momentum compared to the sprawl of You Remind Me of Me.
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I was definitely concerned with using some of the tropes of thrillers, like making sure there were cliffhangers and things that sort of moved the plot forward with each chapter. the like dropping hints that developed the reader's sense of what's going on, and maybe throwing in some red herrings. All of that was very deliberate and was something that I was just interested in playing around with. I've never thought of myself as a writer who knew much about plot and how and sort of the mechanics of plot. And so in some ways I felt like this was I was trying to teach myself about that. By using the, you know, by using a lot of those tropes that you know you see on in movies and TV and in thrillers.
But you remind me of me. You have a timeline to play with, and I'm wondering if plot came about because you had the established timeline versus this, where it's a little looser and we don't quite know how things light up neatly.
Right.
I'm curious from a writing standpoint whether this was more difficult to make everything congeal like this.
You know what? The timeline in Await Your Reply came really in the second draft. Because I didn't, in the first draft, I didn't know what the time relationship between the three pieces was. I think that I had it wrong in some places. When I went back to revise, I was like, oh no, this didn't happen then, this happened before this. So it was actually a second draft issue. And a lot of the plot that sort of revolves around the timeline of Hayden, of his sort of move through these different stories, was something that I worked out towards the end of the first draft.
I'm curious, on a first draft level, how much you actually calculate in terms of these connections, or whether you kind of just figure, you just want to get to the end and then you'll figure it all out in revision.
Well, I mean, revision's really important, and I feel like for me as a writer, I can't do too much outlining, because there's a process of discovery in the way that I, you know, like getting to know the characters tells you what they're going to do and how they're going to behave. And the only way for me to get to know the characters is to follow them without an outline, without sort of any predetermined idea of where they're going to end up. And as I get to know them, I get to know more about how things are going to end for them.
But when you do have the plot in place, does this threaten that spontaneous subconscious process of letting these characters come to life?
Yeah, I think it. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it doesn't for a lot of writers. I mean, I know plenty of writers who have the whole thing figured out, outlined in advance, and it doesn't harm their process at all. For me, there's something that's it's almost a kind of superstition, you know. Like if I know too much, then I lose interest somehow, or that it will become flattened out. And so I really like the process of discovery that goes on when you don't necessarily know what the next stage is. I feel like to some extent that my process, at least my first draft process, is akin to improvisation.
Yeah.
The kind of thing that you would do if you were working for one of these improv companies in a comedy show.
Sure, sure. Well, I'm wondering if there were any times during the first draft where you did, in fact, grow bored. You did, and what you did to conquer that.
Well, I mean, one of the things about the first draft is that it had all of these different branches little pathways that led nowhere.
Sure.
But that's, I guess, part of the fun of the process is that, you know, like I have all these alternate versions of the world, of the story, that in some ways makes it feel like it's fuller, like my understanding of the characters is fuller, because I understand, oh, they could have done that, but they didn't.
Yeah.
And I guess the process of trimming that down and shaping it is really fun, too. That's sort of the second draft process for me, is like taking all of these different possibilities and sort of beginning to shape them and beginning to say, no, that's not something that I'm going to be able to use. That's not a direction that character would take. All of that stuff.
So this big tree that you have with all of its disparate branches essentially ensures that you will continue to actually progress further and put your pedal on the onto the metal on the first draft.
It's a kind of wasteful way to write. I mean, I feel like it's not the way that someone who writes a book a year can write, probably. But I'm okay with that. You know, I'm sort of okay with the wastefulness of it, because it's also, it keeps the process of writing, I think, closer to the to play.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I feel like there's always times when writing stops being fun, and you know. In the later draft stages, some, you know, like when you're trying to make it look good, and when you're trying to get all the get these scenes that are hard that aren't working and all of that stuff, then it's really not fun.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to me that I'm staying as close as possible to what I think of as the origins of why people want to write in the first place, which is, you know, we like to pretend. We like to find out what it's like to be somebody else.
Sure.
And we like to discover things through pretend.
How do you deal with resolution? Because this is a 4-year process.
Right,
and so
right.
You've got to say goodbye to all this play after a
right.
while. What do you do to get to the end, or to, I guess, regrets are sort of thrown to the winds because you know you'll come back to it at the beginning with the next draft? Or?
Yeah. Well, I mean, at some point you do have to let a book go, and I especially do because I've written a couple books now under contract, and there's a certain point where the powers that be are just like, it's time to finish.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, I think at a certain point you're ready to move on. You mean you feel like you've gotten as far as you can with a book, and I don't think any book, at least for me, is ever as good as in your mind you would like it to be. I mean, I would like someday to have written a book that's perfect,
yeah.
But I don't know whether I ever will. And, you know, so, I mean, I feel like I got as far as I could with this book. There are some loose ends that I could have messed around with for a little longer. There are characters I wouldn't have minded following further than I actually do in the novel, but at the same time, I by the time I was really done, I was ready to sort of start working on something new.
Sure, sure. I want to ask about Hayden's conspiracy theories. Were these mm-hmm. based on any specific online exemplars? Did you take any language or anything?
Oh, I mean, I read a lot of I read a lot of stuff like. There were a couple hacker websites or, you know, like troll websites that I was particularly interested in. There's that term, the ruined lifestyle, came up a number of times. A number of people have talked about that. And there were also a couple of interviews and articles following a couple of sort of nationally recognized trolling episodes that were interesting to me, just what those guys had to say and how they thought about the world.
You were looking for specific phrases.
I was sometimes looking for specific phrases, but I was also just sort of looking at philosophy.
Yeah.
And the way that this kind, like a certain kind of rage and disaffection played itself out in the larger worldview of those characters.
Yeah.
I guess they're not characters; they're real people. Yeah. But it's hard to tell online sometimes. What, you know, because
so many identities.
I mean,
I know.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes a lot of these trolls, I don't know how serious they are about what they say.
Yeah.
Because they're trying so hard constantly to get a reaction from people. In the case of Hayden, I think he most of the time believes what he says, I think at some level you believe what you say, but you're still being ironic about it.
Yeah.
Which is this, I mean, it's like this you're looking at yourself from the outside constantly, and I think that's the condition of a lot of these kids. I guess I shouldn't say kids. It's not just kids.
I mean, speaking as someone who's contended with a lot of trolls.
Yeah,
there are a lot of surprisingly, you know, middle-aged people who
yeah. But
I do think
that their condition is sort of constantly outside of themselves in some way.
Yeah.
I mean, they're a projection, and you know, they may in fact just be, you know, sitting in their basement, surrounded by computer equipment. And you know, their mom's bringing them a glass of milk and a piece of cake. Yeah. While at the same time, in their projection, there are these mighty ogres crossing through the internet with, you know, maces filled with nails.
I wanted to bring up, this may relate to the three Ivy League schools we had mentioned before, okay. But you allude to Fibonacci a few times in this book. Bree suggests that human beings are like Fibonacci's rabbits. You describe Hayden's influence expanding outward like Fibonacci numbers, and yet Fibonacci himself is not understood by these characters.
No,
it's
not
a metaphor rather than an actual reference. But I'm curious why you chose Fibonacci over, say, like a Lucas Prime or... Bernotti's logarithmic spiral or anything like that?
Part of it had to do with just, I guess, I was reading a book about chaos theory, and that particular, Fibonacci just seemed like an easy fit for me. It's easy to explain, and I felt like it was more familiar to a general reader than a lot of the other mathematical sort of chaos theory formulas.
Yeah.
I think, and you remind me of me. I talk about Sierpinski's gasket.
Yes.
It's like every once in a while I have a secret sort of Jones for. Like weird mathematical stuff, especially kind of quasi mystical mathematical stuff. And I try to throw it in, but I try not to overdo it. So I'm hoping that Fibonacci is like one of those that most people are familiar with from high school or something.
Well, he was also the basis for Aronofsky's film Pi as well. And that worked out pretty well.
Yeah.
I wanted to also ask about the topography. Lucy looks out the plane and observes the topography, saying, you know, or at least you write, you could see the geometric spread of human habitation, the tiny pencil lines of fields and roads, and the boxy spatter of towns, and it was hard not to think of how it would be to fall, how long you would have to plunge before you finally landed. Similarly, you have Miles confronting this scale model of Stonehenge on campus. It's a half-size replica. And then you have Ryan's eyes settle on a cloud-shaped water stain on the table, and he sees a continent, an imaginary country. And yet... the interesting thing is that these characters' viewpoints of a world in miniature, whether it's real or representative, I mean, they don't actually change their minds. They want to see this, but not actually comprehend this. I'm wondering why you avoided a moment where a character could look out at a landscape that had been permutated in some sense and basically do something more than either disregard it or almost live in fear in relation to it. I'm curious about why there was that artistic decision on this. One moment from the characters, you know.
Right. There is the stuff with Hayden and Miles and their map that they create themselves.
There's the maps, of course.
They have their maps. I'm not exactly sure that any of the stuff that you're talking about was intentional.
Okay.
Maybe it's coming directly from me. I'm not confronting that stuff personally, because I don't think I was necessarily thinking about it in those terms. I think that the three references that you mentioned all kind of come from the same place, which is that I have a Mandelbrot screensaver on my on my computer, and a lot of times when I'm trying to think of what people are seeing, I'm thinking about the way that Mandelbrot works in various different scales. You can see a Mandelbrot when you're in a plane, you know, and you look down at the rivers and the shapes of the hills and stuff. You can see a Mandelbrot in a coffee stain. You can see a Mandelbrot in the clouds. Yeah. I guess I was thinking about that texture more than I was necessarily thinking about it as something about their personalities.
Well, I mean, that's interesting because the specific two-word sentence that crops up, I believe, twice in this book is the topography.
The topography.
Period.
Yeah,
yeah. And so that's why it's interesting that this was mostly subconscious on your part.
Yeah, cause it's, yeah. And I like that word.
Yeah.
Topography.
Topography is a great word. Ryan detecting that what Stacy means by "Do you want to ruin your life?" is actually you are going to end up like your father.
again, in getting inside Ryan's head, it's almost like a double-edged sword here, because on one hand, he needs to know how to perceive the meaning of that statement, but on the other hand, he might be perceiving something entirely different from the purpose.
Than what she intended, yeah.
And I'm curious about, you know, how this relates to this topography situation, too, in terms of why many of these characters are almost... the author has decided to not give them a literal meaning for anything.
Right.
So I have to ask.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm really interested in the level of dramatic irony that exists in everybody's life. I mean, the way in which we don't necessarily interpret what's intended, but interpret in ways that are fraught with our own stuff, and the ways in which that kind of problematic communication keeps us from really being able to understand one another, and keeps us from being able to really be close in some ways. I mean, at least that's true for my characters, and I think it's true for a lot of people. That constant interpretation of what people intend, our sort of constant interpretation of what people are thinking.
Yeah.
I do that all the time. I mean, I'm interested in the way that plays itself out in people's relationships.
Well, does this also explain the tendency to have a maimed character? I mean, you have a hand in this one, and then, of course, you have the dog in You
right.
Remind Me of Me,
right.
And then the ears are always, you know, looked at with some disgust. That, that this is a good way as a comparative point with this failing to comprehend that we're talking about,
right.
That this is essentially kind of an arrow for the reader, or...?
You mean people are missing some part
yes,
of themselves?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I guess so. I mean, I guess this is sort of like a physical manifestation of sort of a spiritual aspect.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to talk, one last question. George Orson is described as a folder of clothes and a maker of lists. Ryan Schuler is a little ghostly bat with a human face. I'm wondering how you arrived at these descriptions. It would appear to reveal something, but it doesn't actually tell us anything mm-hmm. about these characters. And I'm wondering what you did during the course of writing this, because suddenly you have to lay off of very telling descriptive details
right.
for these characters, because it's all a bit of a shell game here.
Right, right.
And what you did to quell that impulse to describe, you know, for the benefit of the book.
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, I had to, when I was going back to revise, I had to think about that a lot.
Yeah.
And go through places where I had described characters to make sure that they didn't reveal too much and that they matched up.
Yeah.
To some extent, they didn't have to match up perfectly.
Sure.
They matched up to some extent. I've never been that interested in direct physical description of characters. I mean, I do it sometimes, but I find, I mean, in when I'm reading, I find it kind of distracting. When you get this sort of portraiture of the characters that like frames them in a certain way. I kind of like to have a free floating idea of what people look like.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean,
you feel the character's environment or
right,
the remnants of environment tells more about the character than how they look like.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. 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 And I just don't feel like I'm very good at describing what people look like.
Yeah.
I think some people are great at it.
Yeah.
Like Sam Lipsight, for example, is really good at describing what people look like.
Yeah.
It's never been like something that I'm drawn to.
Huh. But what about, you know, what people wear or how? I mean, gesture. You've certainly been drawn to.
I do gesture. Yeah. I mean, you think about like things that affect how you. I mean, affect your identity and affect how people respond to you. I mean, those should be parts of it. They're just not things that I've focused on. And this clothes, as you can see, I'm not very
good. Well, hey, I showed up in a t-shirt and shorts, so.
I'm not very good at making judgments based on clothes.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are some descriptions.
You're judging me
right now. Yeah. No, I mean, I think there are some descriptions in there of what Jay wears and what George Orson wears, as seen by Lucy. Or as seen by, you know, as seen by Ryan, where they're sort of like, in some ways, interpreting what those people are like based on that. But in both cases, they're wrong. I mean, because those clothes are actual costumes that the characters are wearing to give off signals that are distracting. You know, they're like colorature in chameleons.
Well, is it safe to say that in order to have a sufficiently specific gesture or detail, that it must almost come from a action and a cause of that action, that this is what motivates something that's more specific?
Yeah.
That's what's going to trigger your brain, like, oh, I've got to grab that and put it in the book.
Right. Well, I mean, it's funny that I haven't thought of this before, actually, but one of the places where I spent the most time thinking about clothes was the makeover, at least Lucy's makeover in Africa.
Yeah.
And then I was actually online, and I went to, like, What Not to Wear and stuff like that.
Oh, really?
So they could get an idea of, like, what kinds of things Lucy should be wearing that she wasn't wearing.
Yeah. Process of elimination.
Right, right.
Wow.
Yeah, a few episodes of Project Runway, et cetera.
Television is a better guide than observation in some cases.
Well, I mean, I live in Cleveland,
yeah.
So you know, I can't go out to Fifth Avenue and see what people are wearing that's cool. So yeah, I mean, Lucy had to be wearing something that was pretty awesome,
yeah.
And I had to find that thing.
Well, if you live in Cleveland, I mean, you have to draw. I mean, Harvey Pekar has drawn quite a bit from Cleveland.
Right.
How much do you draw from just observing people?
Well, you know, there's a lot of Cleveland sections in this, and the two boys, Hayden and Miles, both grew up in my neighborhood, and the kind of suburban life that gets described for them is pretty much, you know, like drawn from life to you know. To the extent that I can know what it's like to grow up as a teenage boy in Cleveland Heights, I was drawing on that.
Well, that happy Cleveland note.
Yeah.
Dan, thanks very much for supporting chatting.
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.